There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. My latest novel, Limelight, is out now in hardback. Thank you so much to everyone who has bought it and read it. It makes me so happy to hear from you. There are signed copies available at indie bookshops all over the country. If you'd like a personalised, dedicated copy of Limelight, or Careering, which is out now in paperback, or any of my books, you can order one from the Margate Bookshop, who deliver nationwide. Hopefully I'll see some of you at Waterstones, Cambridge on Wednesday the 28th of June with Lucy Vine. I'm also appearing at Also Festival on the 15th of July with Ella Bertode, and Prima Donna Festival on the 28th of July with Rebecca Humphreys. More dates to be announced. Now on to today's guest. We talked to the author and The Times chief foreign correspondent Christina Lam at JLS Nova Fushi, a special intimate edition of the Jaipur Literary Festival. We're so grateful to Suniva for hosting us in the resort bookshop, and a special thanks to Melissa Kelly, the Barefoot bookseller. We'll be hearing more from her soon. We're celebrating the paperback publication of Christina's latest book, The Prince Rupert Hotel for the Homeless, a true story of love and compassion amid a pandemic. When the world went into lockdown and Christina couldn't travel, she had to look for stories closer to home. This is an account of what happened when she moved into a hotel which allocated its spare rooms to homeless people over lockdown. As with everything Christina writes, it's impossible not to be deeply moved by this, and most importantly, to end up vowing to do whatever we can to make a difference. We talked about bravery, poetry, travel, and secret sewing circles. Please be aware that in this conversation we do talk about violence against women and other very sensitive subjects, and it might be difficult to listen to. Thank you. So, Christina, I'd love to start by asking if there is a particular book you remember choosing as a younger reader that really ignited your curiosity about the world and what you have gone on to do.
Goodness. Well, I read voraciously when I was a child. We used to have a mobile library, which came, I mean, this was actually in South London, so it wasn't that we were somewhere remote, but a big blue van used to come twice a week, and I used to sit in that van and go through all the books. And then on Saturdays, used to go to the library while my parents were shopping. And I read really indiscriminately. I mean, my parents my father had left school at 14, so wasn't very educated, but he always read a lot. So I tended to often read things possibly quite inappropriate. I mean, I remember reading lots of Dennis Wheatley novels.
Sort of a culty,
black magic-y kind of.
The astral plane.
And science fiction I read a lot, and not really any of the sort of classics. It was much more just anything that we found. And so I actually read more improving books when I was much older.
So were you just sort of on a mission to kind of just be in the library and read whatever you hadn't read before?
Yeah, I just read anything because I read a lot. But I also always read, I mean, loved Russian books. I read like Dostoevsky a lot. And I think because I felt that we lived in a really uninteresting suburb of South London, that there seemed to me a whole big world out there through reading. So I can't particularly say a specific book because it was just so many. But I mean, they were mostly male writers, but I do remember discovering the Brontes and their story and how romantic that was and how they'd written those tiny little books themselves when they were kids. And so I read them a lot.
There is something really thrilling that even now I still think about and think, how did that happen? When they, you know, were, for all I know, they might have been, you know, there knowing no one. For, there might be actually more sort of Bronte information that maybe they were very social and popular and there was a lot going on there. But having to imagine all of those universes, because it was that or kind of be in reality, and that all of those imaginations sort of coexisting and being so discreet but so vivid.
Yes, definitely.
Do you have a favourite Bronte book?
I suppose Wuthering Heights, the romance of Heathcliff. But I do think that reading that made me aware that most of the other books I was reading were by men, apart from Enid Blyton, of course, when I was younger. And Tove Jansson, the Moomin books I used to like. But I always loved poetry, actually. And my dad used to buy me every Christmas something called the Fireside Book of Poems, which was a small collection of books. And that was like one of my highlights at Christmas.
I feel like I can sort of picture that cover. I might have seen it somewhere.
And it's interesting, I was just talking about this with somebody earlier, how lots of war correspondents, a lot of us seem to travel with books of poems. And maybe because, you know, they're short and quick to read, or it's like taking you to some completely different place out of where you are.
Are there any particular poetry books or poets that you like to travel with?
So all sorts of things, but recently I've been traveling with books by a Polish poet called Wisława Szymborska, and her books a lot are about war and what happens during war. But I also read a lot of novels when I'm traveling. I read nonfiction a lot, I think, for work, because being a foreign correspondent, I tend to read books about the places that I'm reporting on. But when I'm traveling, I really like to have a good novel.
Have you brought any with you?
Well, actually, having said that, I really like a good novel. What I'm reading at the moment is Winnie and Nelson, Johnny Steinberg's book, which is an absolutely incredible inside look at the marriage of Nelson Mandela and Winnie Mandela.
Please tell me about it, because I've not read that book, and that is a marriage I have many questions about.
Well, it's very interesting because obviously, you know, he was such an icon. I'm lucky enough to have met him a couple of times because I was based in South Africa. And he's one of those people that really was one of those people that really has this aura about them. And I also met Winnie, who obviously there was a lot of questions about. And so this book, it's sad in a way because it's sort of really exposing what was going on inside that very public marriage. And then, of course, you know, Nelson was in Robben Island in jail for 27 years. And Winnie got involved in all sorts of things. And there's a lot more about the violence in Soweto and the murders of young boys, so-called Mandela Football Club, than I knew about. So, yeah, I really recommend that book.
That does sound fascinating. And does it remind you of when you were there? Are there sort of part, like memories you have that sort of somehow now more vivid in context?
Yes, because some of the places that he writes about I've been to, and also having met them each. Of course, I met them, you know, long after. At the moment in the book, it's early on in their marriage, but I met Mandela when he'd just taken office in South Africa, so that was in 94, and I guess I met Winnie the year after that. But it's always interesting when you have such famous figures and then to start to know a bit more about what was really going on. And Johnny Steinberg found this real treasure trove of letters that Mandela had written during his time incarcerated.
What are some of the biographies and memoirs that you come back to?
So I read a lot. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Ryszard Kapuściński, the Polish, late Polish journalist and travel writer. I absolutely adore his books and have recommended them to a lot of young journalists, books like The Soccer War, because I think it really shows what you can do with journalism. They're sort of narrative and they're very literary books. However, as you probably know, in recent years, there have been a lot of questions about his reporting, that some of the places he wrote about, he wasn't there, or he didn't actually see some of the things, and that also he was working for Polish intelligence. So that's all been really disappointing, because he was one of my heroes. But I still think, you know, despite all of that, there is, you know, a lot of the things he did go and see and report on, he was everywhere, and mostly in Africa, but also in Latin America. This is the time of the Cold War. And, I mean, his writing is just incredible.
That's really interesting how your experience of reading and how that relationship shifts, because I think the intimacy of reading is so intense. And, I mean, even, you know, when reading novels, I get very involved and absorbed very, very quickly. And I, you know, if it's good, I believe in that world. When I'm reading, I'm not thinking this is fiction, which I'm very suggestible, but what it is to have that kind of relationship with a writer, albeit it's sort of, when you're reading, it's kind of one-sided, even though it doesn't feel it. And then to feel, to find out that all is not what it seems.
I mean, as a foreign correspondent, I feel it's really important to actually go to the places, write about what I never write about, something I don't see, and meet the people for yourself. And, you know, it's always very disappointing when you discover that something you've read that you think is really good isn't actually quite what it seems. And unfortunately, that happens quite a lot. And I think there's a real onus on us as journalists at the moment, at a time when there's a lot of questions about fake news and alternative facts, to really, you know, make sure that what we're doing is beyond question. But I also read, you know, quite a lot of foreign authors, and another sort of reportage type writer is Svetlana Alexievich from Belarus. And again, I like reading her because she, to me, shows what you can do with reporting in a different way. So she wrote a book, for example, called The Unwomanly Face of War, which is about Soviet women. And it's like a pastiche of, like, each, she somehow puts together a narrative, but through just one paragraph or a few quotes from each person she's interviewed. It's very clever. So I'm very interested, because, you know, I'm always trying to, I'm a storyteller myself. That's what I do in my journalism and my books, that I'm trying to find ways to convey sometimes quite difficult subjects. And so I'm always interested to see how people have done things in different ways.
Are there any books you remember reading where you sort of have an almost sort of visceral and immediate reaction to, this is about a place and I am going to go to that place, I'm going to get the plane tomorrow?
I mean, I read books when I was a teenager about all sorts of places, just in general, made me very conscious that there was a more exciting world out there than the place I was living in, and that I wanted to go and see it. So it wasn't particularly one book that I read that I thought, okay, I want to go to this place. I think because I was reading so many books, it was quite difficult to just pick one like that. I mean, I also really like Hemingway's books, so because of the craft of it, you know, those very short sentences, very sparse, and the way that, you know, he drives the story on and the characters. I mean, I have some issues with the sort of portrayal of women, but yeah, I'm a big fan of his writing. And then in terms of novels, I actually really like Murakami, the Japanese author, just because it's so different to anything else that I read.
I don't know if this is true or not, and I keep meaning to actually investigate it because it's sort of purely anecdotal, but I think the most sort of common Murakami translations, I think it's the person who translates F. Scott Fitzgerald into Japanese, and they're quite, you know, they're sort of very beautiful and very measured and have that sort of that gravity and that sound. But there is another translator who translates some of the books into English, and it's much shorter sentences, all kind of in the present tense, and it's quite poppy and jumpy, and it's the same story but with a very different feel. And
that's interesting.
I love that sort of that subtlety of it's the same language but it's not. Because I remember reading Murakami as a student. It felt at the time, because I did an English degree, and I really, really struggled with it. I was not, I could not write good academic essays, and I just wanted to read books, and I was bad at reading books about books about books. and reading Murakami felt like a kind of rebellion then, and that voice sort of felt really fresh, and I'd not read stories like those. Do you have a particular novel of his that you especially love?
Like Kafka on the Shore, but Norwegian Woods I also really like, and yeah. I like cats, and cats always seem to feature in his books. But also because recently I've been reporting a lot in Ukraine, so when I report in countries, I like to read not just about those countries, but to read literature from those countries. So like many people, I think I've been discovering belatedly Andrei Kurkov, and I love Death and the Penguin. I think that's a wonderful book.
What do you think is going to happen next in terms of Ukrainian literature?
Well, I mean, the good thing about, if you can say that there's anything positive about the war, but it is meaning that there's a lot more focus on Ukraine, and so people are discovering. I probably wouldn't have read Andrei Kurkov if it hadn't been for the war, unless somebody I knew had randomly recommended it. And so now I've actually met quite a lot of Ukrainian writers, and it's very interesting talking to them. What I do find a bit dismaying is this whole idea in Ukraine now, because, you know, half the country was Russian speaking, and now there's this whole move to not speak Russian, to not have Russian literature at the National Theatre in Lviv. The artistic director, I went when they first reopened last year after the invasion, and they had their first ballet. It was an amazing evening. And I spoke to the artistic director, and he said, we are never going to do Swan Lake or any Russian ballets or music again. And, you know, just to wipe out an amazing culture like that because of the war seems to me very sad. But it's not my country that's been invaded. Maybe I would feel differently.
But it's so hard to know when you think of the Ukrainians who, as you said, speak Russian, and that's very, it's really, really close.
Yeah,
to them.
Zelensky was a Russian speaker, not a Ukrainian speaker.
It's so complicated, isn't it, with the classics? And I think to a point we do get the classics we deserve, that we love this work because it is extraordinary, and it moves
but
us.
Many of those people that wrote things we consider classics, you know, were actually monsters in their private life, or, you know, the way they treated women, or I mentioned Hemingway earlier. I mean, do we then say, okay, we're not going to listen to any of that music or read any of those books because the people themselves were not good people? I don't agree. I think things can still...
Then it does make me wonder how many unperformed alternatives to Swan Lake are there? How many books are there for us to discover that I think sometimes the heaviness of the canon, while I think it's a really important thing to have and refer to, and I, you know, I really, really love it when I read an author and I can feel what they have in there. Well, you know, going back to Hemingway, I love Anne Patchett, as a lot of people do,
actually,
but you can really feel that.
Yeah.
I don't think... I hope she doesn't mind me saying this. I hope it'll get back to her. You can feel the Hemingway, for sure, that we wouldn't have her writing those stories if he hadn't written those stories. And I think it's like, you know, I could never be any kind of builder, We don't want to smash down our load-bearing walls. And perhaps that's what's happening in Ukraine at the moment, that when you take away what we have loved, you take away a bit of us. Have you read this, Claire Derrida, I think?
No.
She wrote a really brilliant piece, The Paris Review, and it is about her growing up as a teenager and loving Woody Allen and Roman Polanski, especially, and sort of that was her intense relationship with those films, and feeling really sort of, you know, frightened and unmoored by what was happening.
Yeah, obviously, once you start to know things about people's... I mean, I don't feel quite the same about Hemingway's work, having read now lots about him as a person, but that doesn't stop me still admiring the writing. I understand. I mean, Ukraine, it's very visceral, right? Their country's been invaded, you know, as we speak. Many people are being killed. So it is something very present, something very, very difficult. I also see, I mean, because of the nature of the work that I do, many places don't have freedom to produce anything. For example, in Afghanistan, which is where I've spent majority of my career, it was the first place I went as a foreign correspondent 35 years ago. After the Taliban fell last time in 2001, going to Herat, which is a beautiful city, it's my favorite place in Afghanistan, near the border with Iran, a very Persian city. And the Taliban had just fallen like 2 days before. And I was walking down a street, and I noticed a sign, and it said Herat Literary Society. So I was intrigued. So I went in, and there was this man in black sitting there. And as you'll remember, I mean, the Taliban, when they were in power before, actually banned books. So which is one thing they haven't done so far this time. So I said to him, Herat Literary Society, how could you have a literary society under the Taliban? And so he told me about how they'd hidden all these books and how they used to meet secretly. And then I said to him, were there any women writers? So then he said, yes, come with me. And he led me down an alleyway, and there was a little placard on the wall, and it said Golden Needle Sewing School in Persian. So I said, what is this? So come in. We went inside. And there was a professor from Herat University, a professor of literature. And then they explained to me that basically there was this quite big group of young women writers in Herat. And when the Taliban had taken over and banned women from doing anything, they sat together and thought, what can we do? What is the one thing we're allowed to do by the Taliban? And they came up with sewing. So they set up this so-called sewing circle. And in fact, what they did, they used to go there twice a week with their bags full of like materials and scissors and sequins and things. Underneath, they had books. They had Virginia Woolf. They had Shakespeare. They had Pushkin. They had books that they then would discuss in this house under the guise of sewing. And their own works. And I mean, it really brought home to me that it shouldn't be that it's a luxury to live in a place with free speech, but that many places don't have that. And that these women were absolutely risking their lives by meeting and discussing books. If they had been caught, they would have been imprisoned. They quite likely would have been hanged. So I said to this professor, you know, you were taking such a huge risk. And he said to me, look, we're poor in everyday life. We don't have to be poor in culture too. So I was incredibly moved by that. And actually, the first book I wrote on Afghanistan is called The Sewing Circles of Herat, because it's a book about lots of things in Afghanistan, but it starts with that. But the sad thing is that, I mean, one of those women was a poet called Nadia Anjuman. And after the Taliban fell, these women started to, you know, write openly. And her poetry did very well. And she sold 3,000 copies of her book, which in Afghanistan, then mostly illiterate country, was enormous. 3,000 copies of poetry book is a lot, actually, anyway. So she started being invited to go and speak at things. Her husband was jealous and furious. And they had a small child. And one day she'd got some invitations and he got very angry and he killed her. And so even, you know, after the Taliban, it was still a very hard situation for women. He was jailed very temporarily and then he was released. He's free now. And I recommend her poetry, by the way. It has unfortunately not been translated into English. But recently I was in Portugal and by sheer chance I was in a place and they were having a book launch at the library that evening and it was to do with Afghanistan. So I was intrigued. And a Portuguese poetry publisher, Nuno Gomes, had heard about this whole story and got her poems translated, and so it was a launch of the book there.
What a devastating and extraordinary story, and that human courage, you know, for those women to come together. It sounds very simplistic, I know, but sort of to bring it back, that's how much it means to people to read.
And well, I guess this has changed now that the Taliban have sadly taken over again, but her grave in Herat became a kind of shrine almost for young women in Herat to go to and remember her story. She was very young when she was killed. I think she was late 20s. After she was killed, I went and wrote a piece of Sunday Times magazine about what happened. And at the time, an American poet actually got in touch with me and said that she was really moved by the story. And so she kind of worked on the translation and then we tried to get people interested. But I think people sort of felt things had moved on from the Taliban. I mean, interestingly, now that the Taliban are back, yeah, it might be a time after the Taliban took power again in Afghanistan, which was such a shock. I mean, for me personally, it was really, people often ask me, don't you get traumatized by the things you report, because I report on war and sexual violence and really terrible things. But in a way, the hardest thing was that, because, you know, to have gone back and forth all those years, seeing things change, and then to see the Taliban just come back again and it to all go back to how it was. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about is there is absolutely no point in making women aware of their rights and talking about gender awareness to women if you don't do anything about the men. And that's one of the things that went wrong in Afghanistan. If you look at the protests that there have been since the Taliban took over, where are the men protesting, right? There's only women. There's a number of men that have protested I can count on the fingers of one hand. And of course, they have been jailed. So other men might say, well, you know, if we come out, this is what will happen. But, you know, that's happening to the women too. I think the story of Nadia Anjuman illustrates the fact that the society was still, even after the Taliban had gone, was still very misogynist, and it was still a very difficult place for women. And so there should have been much more effort made on trying to change that. The thing that I feel strongest about in my writing as a journalist, but also really in books now increasingly, is telling the stories of women and realizing more and more how women have been written out of history.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
We'll be back to Christina soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire Derrida. This is a sensitive and smart exploration of a complicated issue. What do we do with the art made by monsters, and what makes a monster in the first place? It's provocative, exhausting, and brilliant. It didn't give me answers, it posed more questions, but it created a space for uncertainty and confusion and cultural anxiety, and I'm grateful for that. Monsters is published by Scepter and out now. Now back to Christina.
Do you have any favourite funny books, or are there any writers who make you laugh? But I suppose as well, perhaps, you know, when travelling, you don't want to be, you know, in dangerous places and risking reading anything that might make you laugh out loud.
I don't know. No, I said to you, I actually like to read books that take you away from where you are. So that's why I mostly read novels. And I mean, the thing that I'm most dread is being stuck somewhere without anything to read. So I remember a few years ago, I was in, must be about 6-7 years ago, I had been sent to Calais to do something about the jungle, the migrants and refugees there. So I was sent to go and basically spend a day with these people in the jungle, and I'd been there before, and then spend the night with them trying to get onto these trucks. So I did that, and actually my son had just finished his GCSEs and was sort of hanging around feeling a bit kind of sorry for himself that he'd had to do all this work with his revising. So I thought I'll take him with me, because actually a lot of these refugees are also young people. He was 16 at the time. And I was with a photographer who was a friend as well. So I said to him, do you mind if I take Lorenzo? He said, no. So we went to Calais. We go, and it all worked very well, because actually having Lorenzo with us was good, because a lot of the refugees were his age, and so we're chatting to him. Generally, they were a bit fed up with British papers and could be a bit hostile. So it worked very well. We talked a lot. We go out with them on the trucks, come back at maybe 4 a.m, go to bed, get up late in Calais planning. So we all meet up for a late breakfast. Then I was going to write the story and file. And then we were going to go for lunch and head back to the UK. So I'd literally taken an overnight bag. So we're just having this breakfast, and I get a call from my foreign editor saying that there's been a beheading in the south of France, in Bordeaux, I think it was. And he said, there's a train from Calais, like in half an hour, and we put you on it, so like get to this train. So I was like, oh my God. So I have to quickly grab my stuff. I said to Justin, the photographer, do you mind taking Lorenzo back home with you? And he said, no. So I run, get on this train. Then I'm on the train. While I'm on the train, I'm just looking at my phone, and I see reports coming in of a massacre in Tunisia at Sousse on the beach of British tourists. So I call the paper and say, you sure you don't want me to go there? And they said, no, we're covered. So I'm thinking, really, who's there? Anyway, so I have to get this train to Paris and then change to a train to go south. So I change at Paris. I'm on the train south. And of course, then they call me and say, actually, we do need you to go to Tunisia. You're booked on this flight tonight. So get to the airport in Paris. So I'm like, now I'm on this other train. So I have to get off eventually when I could. Get the train back to Paris. Then I discover it's some kind of taxi strike, I think a protest against Uber. So it was really impossible getting to the airport. I just get there on time. I get on this flight and fly to Tunis. And then to arrive there about midnight on the Friday night, I work for a Sunday paper. So our deadline's Saturday. And then I drive, I think it was 3 hours to Sousse. So I get there about 4 or 5 in the morning. And without having had any sleep, when I get there, actually, I get a message saying we still need the piece from Calais. I'm thinking they wouldn't need that. And meanwhile, actually, Lorenzo and Justin's car had a blowout of the tire, so they'd got stuck another day in Calais. Anyway, they actually sent me more stuff. So I write this piece. I didn't go to bed, and then the next morning, I'm on the beach talking to people going to hospitals. It's a horrible story. But it was a huge story because I can't remember the numbers, but more than 30 British, I think, were killed. And so they told me to stay. And I ended up staying there 3 weeks. I had taken one change of clothes. I didn't have anything else. Now, you can buy things right elsewhere, but I didn't have any books to read. And that was the worst thing, to be 3 weeks in a place with nothing. And it was really impossible to get like English books anywhere.
And I'm guessing with that story and that going on, it would have been really good to be able to have some sort of, you know, an hour away from it to kind of process the world where you can be in a different
one. Yeah, just at night when you've been interviewing people all day and it's sort of often traumatic and people, it's terrible things. In that case, you know, it was horrible what people had seen. People had lost relatives, people had been badly hurt. And so like when you go to bed, it's kind of good to decompress reading a novel about something completely different. And I didn't have that. So always now, ever since then, even if I think I'm going somewhere for just a night, I take, like here, actually, I have several books with me. I'm never going to read all those books.
But you do not want to be caught short, not when it is a long flight. So as well as the Winnie and Nelson book, what else have you packed?
So I have The Romanticist, William Boyd's novel.
Oh, I love William Boyd. I've not read that
yet.
Yeah,
I love William Boyd, but I haven't read that yet. So I brought that with me. I bought that at the airport, actually. And I also have Peter Frankpan's latest book.
Is that the absolutely enormous one?
Yes.
Did you pack a hard copy?
Yes, I have.
Wow. I really love William Boyd, and Any Human Heart is a book that I think about a lot. My dad recommended it to me, and I did kind of think, oh, it's going to be a bit of a boys' book, isn't it? I'm not going to like this. And I took it to our local beach. I think I read it in lockdown. We live in Margate in Kent, and I remember it being one like the old cliche, like, I couldn't put it down. I just remember I sort of spent 2 days like with my elbows sort of, you know, up and gripped, not being able to stop. And, you know, it was sort of time for dinner and I was bringing it to the table, which I don't think I've done since I was little.
Sometimes I don't like books like that because I don't want them to be over too quickly. So actually recently I read, I think after everybody else, Lessons in Chemistry, which I think is wonderful. Actually, my mum recommended it to me, and that I was reading way hours every night, and so I wasn't getting enough sleep really, and it was all over too quickly.
I'm sort of trying to ration it. We've had Bonnie on the podcast, and it was really fascinating hearing about how she, you know, researched it and put it together by finding sort of 1950s chemistry textbooks that you can't really, even though you sort of can Google everything you need to know, you've got to be very specific about, you know, the knowledge that would have been available at that time. But that is such, again, that's another story about, you know, monstrous men and brilliant women finding sneaky ways to surge up.
I think it also appealed to me because a little known fact about me is I went to university to study chemistry.
So, I didn't know that.
Even though I actually managed to switch subjects after a year. But
did it bring it back? Did it make you want to?
It certainly didn't make me bring it back. My mind is interesting. I remember almost nothing of the chemistry that I did. It's as if the moment I switched subject, my mind just rejected all of the chemistry I'd ever learned.
as if it knew. Yes. That was not what you wanted. Me. That was not the way.
I didn't look at school. I always wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a novelist. I didn't. I did science. I feel kind of angry about it because I went to one of the last grammar schools, and if you were bright, so my best subjects were English and history and language, really. But they made this feeling that if you were one of the brighter girls, that you should do science because only stupid people did art subjects, right? So there was never really a question that I would do arts A-levels. So I was channeled into doing chemistry, physics and maths, even though I didn't like any of those subjects. I wanted to be a writer and my best subject was English. So, and of course, then when I applied for university, you cannot apply to do English degree with a chemistry, physics and maths A-level. So, yes, so I always feel slightly annoyed about that. I think it's very wrong to make people, and this whole feeling too, I mean, I was told always, you know, you, how can you be a writer? How could you, how, that's not a career. How can you make money and how could you live as a writer?
You seem to be doing fine. It's funny though, isn't it? Because I do remember that snobbery sort of when choosing this idea that, you know, fiction and novels and literature is something we've always had and needed, and we've always been storytellers, and it's always how we've made sense of each other and connect with each other. And then, you know, I think until relatively recently, when you think of how long we've been writing things down, it's sort of like, you know, oh, a novel, how grubby. But then I do quite like grubby novels, so I can't.
It wasn't that it was grubby, it was just the idea. I think my family, they couldn't imagine a job that wasn't a conventional job, like you became a teacher, or I, if I was doing chemistry, I could become a pharmacist. Yeah. Not, but my school was like that too.
I always think your parents want you to do a job where you could show them a drawing of it. It would be quite easy to recognize. Finally, I'd love to ask you about the, other than any books that you've brought with you on holiday, if there are any books coming up that you're excited about reading or books that you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, I mean, I think now, like I told you earlier, for a long while, I hadn't read any of the classics when I was a teenager or anything. So I really, apart from the Brontes, so for a long while, I was kind of catching up, I think, on reading things that I feel like I probably should have read earlier. But now I absolutely read for pleasure. But my greatest pleasure really is discovering non-English authors, you know, from other places, because it's often very different. And somebody I discovered quite recently is a Rwandan writer called Scholastica Mukasonga. A number of wonderful books. They're quite small books. One of them's called A Barefoot Woman. And she writes, you know, I talked earlier about how I like using different ways to tell difficult stories. And she writes about the Rwandan genocide, actually, but through family experiences, through experiences of girls at a convent school. And I think her writing is magical, really wonderful.
That sounds like a book I really want to read. And I've got to say, I'd be frightened of to, you know, a book about genocide. It's quite complicated, but the human storytelling and the people affected, that sounds really vivid.
Yeah,
and that's,
well,
like,
as somebody who's written a book about war rape, it's quite weird when you've written a book and people buy that tell you, oh, I've bought your book, and you can't say, oh, I hope you enjoy it.
What do you say?
Of course, I'm delighted always if people have bought my books. So, and it's, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote that book is because I feel so strongly about what's happening and I want people to know. It's, you know, it's a campaign really, as well as a book. So I always say to people, I hope you find it interesting.
Christina, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. It's been so fascinating and enlightening. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think I can say that, well, and being informed by the moving and tragic parts.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
Huge thanks to Christina and to the Sanova Fushi JLS team. The Prince Rupert Hotel for the Homeless is published by William Collins and out now.
Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can find all the books that Christina mentioned at acast.com/booked, and you can see a selection at bookshop.org. You can find us and follow us on social media at whybooked. Huge thanks to everyone who's given us a 5-star review. We really, really appreciate it. And if you haven't done it yet and you've been listening for a little while, we'd love it. It's the best way to help people to find the podcast and their new favourite book. Finally, I leave you with this from Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Culture does not make people. People make culture. If it is true that the full humanity of women is not our culture, then we can and must make it our culture. See you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.